seemingly, you know, it's still a minority, but it, you know, of people who are, you know, who are the street fighters, like the Proud Boys and the 3%ers and stuff. But, you know, their goal is to you know, gain, you know, is to create mayhem and to, you know, I don't know if they're gaining supporters. I mean, though they, you know, I guess the main support that was gained by that movement was gained under Trumpism. So that you're totally right as far as the, you know, driven by political ideology is where we need to keep the focus, you know, which led to the, you know, the January 6th insurrection. Anyway, we only have like a minute left. I'll just give you the last word.
Oh, geez, that's a lot of pressure. I agree with Kathy or whoever it was that said that we need more discussion of the political analysis of what's going on and why people are choosing. Because there is a time, I mean, I'm nonviolent as a tactic, not as a philosophy, partly because I don't think I would survive serious violence.
Okay, well, I got to let you go on that note. Sorry, my apologies. Thank you for calling, Rachel. We are out of time, and apologies to Edie, who was on stack, got a call a little earlier. Thank you for everybody who called in. This has been an interesting conversation. This is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio. Thanks, Ty, for operating the board, and thanks to everybody for listening. Bye-bye.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8:59 a.m.
Are you a fan of the independent film news and interviews on The Film Show? Well, you won't want to miss the new and expanded Words and Pictures, coming in 2019. That's right. The Film Show and Words and Pictures are coming together to fill the airwaves with the most creative happenings and fertile minds in screencraft, stagecraft, comics, and animation. So tune in to KBOO twice a month, 11:30 a.m. every second and fourth Thursday in 2019 and beyond, for the very best of the narrative arts on the new Words and Pictures.
Back home, folks. Does your employer have a matching gifts program? Many companies offer dollar-for-dollar matching charitable contributions for donations you make to KBOO. The impact of your gift may be doubled or possibly tripled. Participating companies also match gifts made by retirees and or spouses. Matching gifts are a great way for you to maximize your membership dollars. Check with your company's human resources or accounting departments to find out if your employer matches charitable contributions, then request a matching gift form. For more information on companies making matching gifts, go to kboo.fm/employer matching.
Now with the Taliban back in power, the fate of the people of Afghanistan actually rests with the international community. I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive.
What's going on?
He's not breathing.
Can you get a pulse?
Barely.
Call a code.
Get an ambulance back from the nurse's station.
Heart's still working, means synapses are still firing. We just need to get a message through.
Prosperity for the few. The rights of U.S. corporations to extract from the land of Central America and exploit the people of Central America.
What we've really seen is a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
There's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. People don't feel that they can do very much.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
It is debatably the biggest mess, the most disastrous foreign policy embarrassment in modern U.S. history. No, we're not talking about what the mainstream media is focused on, the state of the American exit from Afghanistan. The images are one thing, but the numbers tell a different story. Tens of thousands of Americans and their allies are out, and the U.S. government is going full tilt Dunkirk, requisitioning private commercial airliners to take out more who want to leave. No, the truly historic mess is the over 40 years of American intervention in Afghanistan. Winning the war was the easy part for the Taliban. governing and working with the international community is the hard part, which has just barely begun. The disaster, which is just starting to be mended, started when President Carter's National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski wrote to the president saying, essentially, we now have the opportunity, this is in 1979, we now have the opportunity of giving the USSR its Vietnam War. U.S. policy was to support and build up the Mujahideen, complete with advanced weapons, to give the Soviets a black eye. As with the so-called great game between Russia and the British Empire played out in Afghanistan, the welfare of the people of that nation wasn't even a consideration. So now the U.S. is the latest empire to die in that graveyard of Afghanistan. The many decades of war are over. As was said by Fareed Zakariyyeh, there is no elegant way to lose a war, end of quote. Now the mainstream media is doing one thing that it does well, stoking the flames of fear. A government is now beginning, which has been inevitable in its coming throughout the current war. Will they be brutal, cutting off heads, requiring women to stay home or wear traditional Islamic dress, keeping females from going to work or girls from attending schools? I'm not sure anyone knows the answer, but as our perceptive guest today, Murtaza Hussein, examines in his article in The Intercept, the international response to the Taliban's ascent will shape Afghans' fate. Murtaza Hussein is a reporter at The Intercept who focuses on national security and foreign policy. He's appeared on CNN, BBC, MSNBC, and other news outlets. According to our guest, the Herculean task before the Taliban in shifting from war to governing is avoiding global isolation, repairing their abysmal reputation, and stemming brain drain from the country. Murtaza Hussein, thanks so much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive.
Thanks for having me.
Though we must think with history, the question we'll focus on today is, what is next? When the new leaders have appeared before the international news media, they've struck a surprisingly conciliatory tone. And as you note, during their previous time in power in Afghanistan from 1996 to 2001, the Taliban became international pariahs due to their brutal treatment of women and minorities. And the minorities in Afghanistan are many, including the Sikhs and the Shia Muslims. Destruction of historical landmarks and harboring of international terrorist groups, end of quote. Is it not the same Taliban who have clearly insisted that they will govern according to their interpretation of Islamic law? Is it not reasonable to have, quote, fears about what type of social order they plan to impose on the country and how women and minorities will fare under their rule? What factors might be motivating them now to actually address these fears, Murtaza?
Well, there are a number of factors. First of all, the Taliban has had a very the Afghan war essentially opened Afghanistan up to the forces of globalization in a very violent way, but it occurred nonetheless. In the 1990s, when the Taliban took control of the country, it was in the midst of a horrifying civil war that broke out following the expulsion of the Soviets from the country, where the various Mujahideen forces, which had expelled the Soviets, turned on one another. Many of them were awful warlords who preyed on the population, and they used the weapons they'd been given to set up for their own personal fiefdoms. And amid all that horrifying violence, the Taliban emerged initially as a popular movement of students, as the name Taliban refers to their origins as religious seminary students. And their war was against the warlords, and they succeeded in taking control of the country. But unfortunately, as it became very known for later on, they imposed their own very theocratic and oppressive rule over Afghanistan. And they made the country, they opened the country up to international terrorist groups, which some of whom inevitably end up using the country to carry out attacks against the United States, ultimately the 9/11 attacks, which the Taliban themselves, there's no indication they ever knew about beforehand, but were nonetheless, it took place on their watch and they suffered the consequences of the 2001 invasion. Now, after that 2001 invasion, Afghanistan was flooded with foreign troops from all over the world, NGOs. There was a gigantic influx of money in various forms directed to the country for various different purposes. And, it changed Afghan society quite a bit. There was quite a transformation, and the Taliban themselves were not immune to these changes. They fought a war against the United States for 20 years, the most powerful military force on the planet, along with its international and local allies. And as a result of that, they had to really adapt. So they had to open them. They were based in Pakistan for a lot of that time, which is a far less isolated country. They had to engage in various forms of diplomacy or negotiation. They had to transform their own practices, and both strategically in terms of combat, but also politically in terms of their relations with the world as a whole. And, you know, they've changed. They've become more sophisticated. Now, does this mean that they necessarily are going to govern in a radically different way with their power than they did in the 1990s? I think that that's still a subject to question. As you said, they're certainly saying different things now, and they have said and done things which you never would have imagined doing in the 90s, in the sense of the statements about respecting women's rights and the right to go to work and school. And also they took part in some ceremonies for Shia Muslims and Sikhs, who Shia Muslims in particular, they were very oppressive towards when they were last in power in the country. The problem is that there are divisions inside the Taliban. It's a very large movement. And, you know, there's a political leadership, much of which spent time abroad during the past several years in Qatar or various other countries, Turkey. And, you know, they were negotiating with the U.S. and their other parties, and their views have somewhat, you could say, moderated or become more pragmatic. And there's also the military leadership, which stayed in Afghanistan throughout the time, and they were fighting the war. And they were the ones making these big sacrifices in combat, and they weren't, they were focused on, you know, fighting the war and prosecuting the war against the U.S. And those people tend to be more hardline on these issues and social issues. And they also have more legitimacy with the rank and file, because they can say that, look, we were here fighting the whole time. We weren't just hanging out in Qatar in our nice home, or in Dubai or Turkey or wherever else. You know, we are the ones who were here the whole time fighting. So their views are likely to prevail. And it's not so atypical. If you look at the movements which have political and armed wings in other scenarios, it's the armed wing that really gets to have its views become normative. So they have the guns, so that's how it is.
Yes, and we've certainly seen that with the IRA in Ireland and many, many other places. And I had a professor back in college who said that he defined politics as the economy of violence. You know, who has the guns, it really matters. Now, ever since the early 80s, the precursors to the Taliban, and then with the 2001 destruction of the Buddha temples of Bamiyan, which were in Afghanistan, my impression was the Taliban have thumbed their noses at world opinion. It seems like that was a part of the very identity. Your article in Intercept quotes an anonymous source saying of the Taliban, "They know they cannot govern Afghanistan without the support of the international community." And as you point out, President Biden suggested the group might be willing to bend to international opinion out of necessity. Now, this is quite a turnaround. Your thoughts about that?
Well, you know, look, the Taliban does not want to repeat what happened in 2001 or the early 90s before that, when they became an international pariah. And the movement was destroyed, and the leadership was scattered. Many of them were killed. It was a very painful experience for them. They want to govern Afghanistan as the government of the country, and they want their rule to be stable and sustainable as possible. Today, Afghanistan, you know, it's been suffered for 40 years from the civil war. It was a poor country before that. It's completely dependent on the goodwill of the international community to provide basic. You know, the basics of life, the healthcare, food insecurity is a huge problem. 80% of the healthcare system is funded by foreign funding. If all that was pulled and they became a pariah internationally, and there were sanctions even applied to the country, it would be a disaster. Millions of people could die. And the government that the U.S. built in the last 20 years did not in any sense reflect, you know, the interests or needs of ordinary Afghans. It was a small elite of people who collaborated with the, you know, foreign occupation of the country, enriched themselves in large part. There are some pockets of urban areas where, you know, things did improve for people's lives in Kabul and the centers of urban areas. And women's rights did improve. But for the vast majority of people, it's an overwhelmingly rural country. Their lives did not change at all. Their lives got a lot worse because there's a horrible war going on, including women. And So, you know, they have a very big challenge now. And if they can't govern Afghanistan as like they did before, as pariahs, it will just end the same way again, which they don't want.
Yeah, for sure. And it's as certainly it's a very large geographic area, and it's mountainous. The terrain is exceedingly challenging. And my sense is there's Kabul, but then there's a whole bunch of separate regions that don't probably have a heck of a lot to do with the capital city and the central government. I mean, central government? I don't know if that's in their tradition at all. And you write, they care about whether or not they can hold together the society that they in fact say they care so much about. I would guess that there are, you know, it's, as you say, it's not monolithic. I mean, what political party is? Well, I suppose the Trumpists are now. I would guess that there are a number of factions within the large group of Talibans spread out over that very large and diverse geographical area. Could the effort at looking good be being done grudgingly? Can they really do this with the sincere enthusiasm that's required? Your thoughts?
You know, it's difficult. It's difficult to say. Every movement or every country or every every paramilitary group in the world now, they're engaged in a very intensive effort at public relations. There's no one is exempt from this. You could look at, for a contrast example, you look at ISIS. They engage in public relations, but their public relations were aimed at the opposite of most other groups' public. They were trying to make themselves look as, unpalatable and as savage and terrible as possible. Now, the Taliban is not interested in that. It seems like they would like to be, they're doing public relations in a way which wants to portray themselves as a part of the international system and with values to some degree in line with other countries, or at least palatable to them and supportable by them. So, you know, what the reality is in every case is always a bit different from what the perception that goes for the United States. For Afghanistan, there's no exception to that rule. So I'm assured that there will be some variance between the image that they seek to portray and the reality, especially across a large country of 40 million people inside of Texas. But you know, what matters more is what people perceive them as, and the effort that they take to portray a certain image will be, in some sense, determinant of that.
Yeah, perception is extremely important in politics, Lord knows. And another big factor is money. Money tends to be a significant factor in politics, and as you note, the U.S. government has moved to freeze billions of dollars held by the Afghan government in foreign accounts, while the United Kingdom has indicated that economic sanctions against Afghanistan are on the table, end of quote. During the prior U.S. version of government, as you point out, the U.S. sent weekly dispatches of hard currency to Afghanistan. This approach, freezing assets, the U.S. did it when our favorite, the Shah of Iran, was overthrown. We froze their assets, and look what they did. We have imposed economic sanctions and blockaded Cuba since its popular revolution in 1959. All I see resulting from that strategy is to make poor people poorer and stiffen the resolve of the government and enable them to blame any and all problems on the U.S. blockade, the outside aggressor. It helps bring great unity. According to your understanding and analysis, how will this tactic work? What effects do you think it will have? Is there any way such an approach might benefit the Western powers? Is there a diplomatic strategy in such approach, or what is this approach?
Well, look, the situation now is that the U.S. has withdrawn from Afghanistan. It invested $1 trillion or more in that country, 20 years of say attention and manpower were devoted there, and within a week the entire project fell apart. Literally the moment that the air cover was pulled from the Afghan security forces, the entire government revealed itself to have had no legitimacy the whole time. The entire thing was a lie. There were 20 years. You can go back and look every year. You can see top military officials, top political officials saying things are going so well. Every year from 2001 onwards or 2002 onwards. And it was all complete lie. Wow. Now what? So then there's a book I highly recommend that's coming out in a few weeks. It's based on the Washington Post reporting on the Afghanistan papers. I just finished reading it yesterday, but it's really an eye-opening documentation of the history of this entire period and the concealed failures based on documents that they had sued, had released. But, you know, so now that this has happened, like, we can't go back and change the past, obviously. So what now? Now, this is Taliban government power. Afghanistan is mostly the same as it was, but not entirely. There are differences. Some people did make life to get better in some areas, in some urban areas. Some there's an elite class created or the educated class created in Kabul and other cities. So if the U.S. would like to keep some of the gains it made in that time, it has leverage to do that because it created an Afghan system which is heavily reliant on foreign aid in the first place. So, you know, they could just walk away, you know, they could impose sanctions and the whole thing could collapse and everything go back to the 90s, which were the bad old days in Afghanistan. And the country could become more dangerous for the West and so forth, too. There could be a refugee crisis, millions of people fleeing the country potentially if it collapses in that sense. Or they could use their leverage and learn to compromise a bit and use the financial leverage they have to exert a certain influence over the country, preserve it from collapsing, stop the refugee flows that would come towards Europe. You know, they've been cooperating with the Taliban for several years to fight ISIS, which is a shared enemy of the Taliban and the United States. So that cooperation can be leveraged to prevent terrorist attacks emanating from Afghanistan against neighboring countries or in the West. Taliban does not wish to repeat the experience of the 90s where some of its guests, including Al-Qaeda, undertook actions which resulted in the destruction of their government. They do not want that to be repeated. So there's actually quite a few mutual interests here which can be leveraged. It just depends, you know, what the response of the U.S. will be. And a big problem is that the U.S. elite at the moment is very humiliated by what happened. It's a very embarrassing turn of events. And they don't seem like they're in any mood for a compromise or for thinking about this, you know, coolly. They're angry. So, you know, it depends. Maybe they'll throw out everything that they, even the small bit that they did gain over 20 years at great cost, might decide to abandon that as well.
Well, you spoke of a few things I need to comment on. You talk about lies. I am so old, I lived through the lies of Vietnam. It was just lie upon lie upon lie, constantly saying we were winning, the light at the end of the tunnel. Not true. The other thing, humiliated. There's this whole macho thing about being humiliated. We can't be humiliated. We got to be tough. We got to be strong. Boy, that way of thinking, it usually doesn't end well. You know, if we can get over the hurt of the ego, it could be a lot better for everybody involved. For those who may have just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is called Keeping Democracy Alive, and we hope you are participating in your area keeping democracy alive. Our guest today is Murtaza Hussain, who has written in The Intercept, "The international response to the Taliban's ascent will shape Afghans' fate." And talk about money again. The World Bank and International Monetary Fund holds tremendous political power around the world by holding the power of the purse. They make loans. They charge interest. They can be very, very tough and hurt a lot of poorer people in particular. And for many decades, they've wielded tremendous impact on developing nations, oftentimes causing widespread suffering by requiring full payback of interest on their loans. Where are they in all this? I haven't heard.
Well, the IMF is supposed to deliver $400 million to Afghanistan a few days ago. And the way the country is set up at the moment, it requires regular infusions of cash to pay civil servants to just have the banks be able to fulfill people's daily needs. And owing to the instability, that money was not delivered. And it's unclear if it's going to be resumed or what's going to happen. There's a lot of unknowns. One issue also is that the Taliban is not very experienced or sophisticated at negotiating with international donors. I mean, they're going to have to learn how to do. So it's a really big question. I can't really say at the moment what they will do or what they might do. But certainly we could say that, you know, if there was a complete inability to find a compromise and there was a cessation of all international aid, including IMF loans to Afghanistan or contributions to Afghanistan, we would see a grave humanitarian crisis. And I think that another issue is that because this all happened so quickly, it's difficult to really know what's going to happen. No one was expecting this to happen, that the country would fall in a week. Not even the Taliban themselves. They're quite surprised by their sudden victory in the country. So a lot needs to be unpacked right now, and people are, institutions even are floored by what happened.
You know, it's interesting, for 20 years just propping up this alleged government. I mean, we had the same darn thing in Vietnam. You know, the people had no connection to the government in Saigon. And that didn't fall quite as quickly. But, you know, there are similarities, a lot of similarities that we'll talk about later. And tell us, please, about the concerns in your article that are expressed by Ashley Jackson. She's co-director of the Center for the Study of Armed Groups at the Overseas Development Institute, and she's also author of Negotiating Survival, Civilian-Insurgent Relations in Afghanistan. What concerns did Ashley Jackson express that you quoted?
So, Ms. Jackson has a lot of experience in Afghanistan. She's negotiated with all parties there, including the Taliban, or had contact with them. And, she's concerned about many of the same themes that I discussed here, but basically, are there going to be talks with the Taliban? Will there be some sort of negotiation with them? Will there be like a punitive response in the wake of this event in which they took over the country? It's, I've been speaking to experts on Afghanistan for the past 2 weeks constantly, and they're all kind of have a similar take, which is they're all shocked. They're all concerned about what's going to happen now. And she especially was concerned that, if the international community walks away from Afghanistan now, there will be terrible consequences for many ordinary Afghans. Because as flawed as the system was that was put in place there for the last 20 years, it's a system that people live under. And, the U.S. system is, of course, much better, but has deep flaws, and some people would like to abolish it. But if you just pull the rug out from people in any circumstance and walk away, then there's going to be a tremendous amount of chaos and suffering. And Afghanistan is a very poor country, and the people don't have much way to by which to insulate themselves. So her concern was really about the international community's response now and, the consequences if they do choose to completely walk away. And if they take a hard line towards the Taliban that does not include some sort of prospect of reciprocity or, trading something with them, leveraging their need for money in exchange for concessions on human rights, women's rights, or the status of Afghans who work with the United States. So, she's trying to, like many people, she's trying to be a voice in the wilderness and impart some sort of reason or conciliatory nature in a very, very agonizing moment for everybody.
And being reasonable, throughout the United States, the initial reaction, we just see the chaos at the airport and in the towns, and there's people, quite frankly, confuse ISIS and Al-Qaeda with the Taliban. And it's interesting that you point out that the Taliban's enemy was ISIS. And the fear is there. I can't tell you how many people are afraid, and when you have fear whipped up, people don't necessarily act in the most positive and productive manner. But it's important now that, as you say, they don't want chaos. They want a stable Afghanistan now. They have to do this. This is their motivation. And it's curious to me about their resources. You write that Afghanistan today is economically dependent on the international community in very basic ways. Do they not have valuable natural resources so they might be able to either go it alone or use that stuff as leverage? I don't know what natural resources they have, but I've heard they have a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, there are a lot of rare earths in Afghanistan, which are very important for production of high-tech goods, cell phones and laptops and sensors and screens and things like that. Some estimates say $1 trillion worth eventually is located in Afghanistan. The issue is that they don't have the ability to, security situation is difficult there. They don't have the ability to, you know, run the mining, processing, manufacture, and export of these products, or, you know, even just the extraction of the raw materials. Very difficult. They need foreign support. They need a stable environment and investment. But the thing is, even if the U.S. leaves, this is also the counterpoint, is that there could be, you know, Chinese investment. China is right across the border from Afghanistan. They're very keen on working with the Afghan government, and they don't care about the nature of the government per se. They're willing to work with them regardless. I would say from the perspective of Afghans, and this includes the Taliban, if they're in power now, which seems likely, they do need to have a good relationship with the U.S. and the West as much as possible, because you don't want to be in a situation where your only foreign partner, your major foreign partner, is just one country. That country would be China. You want to be able to have leverage. You want to be able to have, you know, leverage parties against each other, have a cooperative relationship with the West as the alternate power broker. So, you know, I think that's also why they're trying to be as conciliatory as possible right now in their messaging. They're helping facilitate now the withdrawal of Americans and some Afghan allies of the United States from the country. They're not killing them or trying to prevent them to do that. They're trying to be perceived as a responsible partner with the international community as much as possible. And secondly, they would like, once the U.S. leaves, to not be an implacable enemy, but view them with some degree of nuance so that they can continue getting some cooperation on things of shared interest.
I'm sure. So they, you know, they need expertise. Like if you have various rare earth substances in the ground, you got to have some tools to get it out of the ground and ways to deliver whatever that stuff is. And that's not always easy. It could be in the ground, but if you can't get it from point A to point B, you can't make any money. So they know they have to do that. Let me just see where we are. A little bit of noise there. As I've said, it's one thing to wage a war.